we have two people that have literally vanished into the wilderness.
Greg Lynn lost his temper.
I panicked to save myself.
How does a pilot turn into a murderer? I found long-buried secrets simmering just below the surface.
Everyone was scared of him. She was pleading. I thought, this is not good.
Anybody that would kill their wife's pet is a monster.
Huntsman, the latest season of the ABC's true crime podcast, Unravel. Hear Unravel now on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
The huge jungle island of Borneo sits to the northwest of Australia. It's famous for its rainforest. It's one of the oldest in the world, which contains orangutans, the Borneo elephants, and the clouded leopard. At the outbreak of World War II in the Pacific, Borneo was captured by Imperial Japan, which badly needed its rich reserves of oil and rubber. And then, in the very last months of World War II, the decision was made, largely by our American allies, to send in the Australian Army to dislodge the Japanese forces on Borneo. This was called Operation Oboe. It was a triple-pronged attack, and it was one of the largest amphibious landings of the whole war. The fighting was brutally hard, and it unfolded in a place that was both like a hell and a paradise. Operation Oboe was brilliantly executed by the Australians and a total success. But at the time, and afterwards, many people questioned the need for all that fighting and dying on Borneo in the first place. Michael Veitch is back on Conversations today to tell this forgotten story. Michael is the author of many highly acclaimed histories of Australians at war, and his new book is called Borneo, The Last Campaign, Australia's Brilliant Controversial Ends to World War II. Welcome back, Michael.
Great to be here, Richard. Thank you.
You begin your book with an unlikely encounter. An unlikely encounter between you. This is back in the days. This is back in the 1990s when you were a TV comedian on Fast Forward with Magda Szubanski and Mark Downey and many others as well. And an encounter between you and former head of the Victorian RSL, Bruce Ruxton, the late Bruce Ruxton. Tell me how this came about.
Yes, unlikely bedfellows. As you said, it was just after I'd finished my career on television, or television had finished its career with me, more likely. The ABC comes into it. ABC Radio National were doing these live-to-air quizzes, and somebody had heard that I was interested in military history, and I was asked to become part of RN's weekly quiz. We all turned up to a very cold hall in the suburbs of Melbourne in dead of winter. It was freezing. They hadn't turned the heaters on. And, yeah, it was three people battling it out with questions of Australian military history. I was on one team. There was an army officer on the other team. He turned out to be completely useless, knew absolutely nothing. But the other person on my team was Bruce Ruxton. And he was very grumpy because my friend Jeff Brooks used to characterise him with a character called Bruce Rump.
Bruce Rump. I remember Bruce Rump. Yeah. And he'd have a
fucking
hat. Yeah, and he had a funny hat on and he was always complaining about
it. He was always complaining.
About modern Australia.
Oh, well, that was Bruce Ruxton's mantra, complaining about every aspect of modern Australia. And he was always good copy. Journalists used to, when they have a slow day, ring Bruce, get him to opine about something that he doesn't like, and well, that's a good filler. And he was quite grumpy until the very end. We lost the quiz, but something made me say, "Oh, Bruce, I believe you were in Oboe. You went to shore at Balikpapan, which was the last of the Oboe landings." And he stopped. He turned on his heels and looked at me with these piercing blue eyes and said, "How the hell did you know that? Come over here. We'll have a chat about it." For the next hour, we sat on these two chairs as the ABC were packing up, and he became an utterly different person.
He became a
soft, gentle. And I realised that particularly this campaign, the fellows that came back were so ignored. Nobody cared. Australia was at the end of the war. Nobody cared. The battles of the Oboe campaign, Borneo, didn't even make the front pages. They were buried on page 5 and 6. And so they came back. You had the whole Sandakan thing happening concurrently, the dreadful death march. The soldiers didn't know that was happening. They came back. Nobody wanted to know. It had been a horrible campaign. And I kind of felt the kind of bitterness and the loneliness and like, what was that for in Bruce? And I realised oh, that's the source of a lot of his anger.
What did he tell you about going ashore on Borneo, on the east coast of Borneo?
He went ashore at Balikpapan, which was the last one that went in July. He was actually trained as an army surveyor, but then went into the infantry. And he went in a couple of days after the first landing. By this stage, the battle had gone inland, and it was a terrible slogging, almost like trench warfare in some areas.
But in fantastical conditions.
Fantastical conditions. Yeah. Unbearable humidity, worse than New Guinea. It was the worst they'd ever seen. Deep ravines, jungle, entrenched positions that the remnants of the Japanese had built over the past 2 years. And Bruce saw some awful things. I mean, the atrocities committed by the Japanese were unbelievable, and not just on combatants, on Malay and Chinese civilians. And he saw a lot of that, and I don't think he'd ever spoken about it. He spoke about it a bit to his biographer, but that was the germ years ago of me writing this book.
How did you see him off that night?
There was a pub closing, and I kept looking at the pub. It was in Albert Park. I said, oh, do you want to go for a beer? Because the ABC are packing up. And, he said, oh, and it was one of those awkward moments where if I'd said, oh, come on, he would have said yes. But, no, look, it's getting a bit late. But, no, let's – and he gave him my phone number. And I found it about a year ago as a bookmark in a book. I never rang him, and he died, and I've always regretted not ringing him. It's kind of like, you know, one of those lessons – do it. Take that little step forward to do these things because you might not get another chance.
So let's talk about Borneo, the island itself, this huge rugged island.
The size of New South Wales. It's very, very big.
Very big and very rugged. So, and it sort of sits in the South China Sea sort of between Singapore, Philippines to the north, Java to the south.
That's it.
It sits on its own there.
Yeah, yeah. And it's now divided between Malaysia, the old British part, North Borneo, and Indonesia, the old Dutch part.
So that was occupied by the Japanese early on.
A very high priority for them to get it.
For the oil and for the rubber primarily?
Yes. Huge oil reserves and a really particularly fine oil that they could just pump out of the ground and put directly into the tanks of ships. It was extraordinary, and that they didn't even have to refine it. So the Japanese wanted it and needed it, invaded it. I think the first invasion was in 1941 still. They actually just went straight for Borneo, took it after a fight of a few days against the defending Dutch East Indies troops, murdered anybody who was there. They even murdered the people who knew how to run the refinery, so they had to wait for months to get it up and running. But then they eventually did, and it produced huge amounts of oil for them for a couple of years.
So Borneo's taken within weeks of Pearl Harbor being attacked, and the Japanese are coming south. They're occupying parts of northern New Guinea. And then the United States sends General of the Army Douglas MacArthur to Australia to help launch an Allied defence of Australia, retaking of New Guinea, the Philippines, and then the attack on Japan.
Yeah. Now,
wasn't it in Adelaide or somewhere like that MacArthur made his famous promise, I shall return?
No. It was in a railway siding a couple of hundred kilometres north of Adelaide in the middle of the bush. People are a little bit unfair about Dugout Doug. I mean, he was directly ordered by the president to get out because you are needed. So he was ordered to abandon his men, and he obeyed the order. They were all taken prisoner, of course. PT boats, and then a flying fortress came and picked him up from the Philippines just in time before he was captured, landed in Darwin. His wife said, I'm not flying anymore. That's been awful. I want to go by train. The train line didn't go all the way, so they had to. It sort of petered out. They kept changing trains to smaller and smaller trains, and finally they were in the north of South Australia, and the press found out, and it was supposed to be secret, and suddenly he had to give an impromptu press conference and would not take questions. But that's when he said, he gave a preamble and said, I've left the Philippines, but I shall return.
Not the Allies shall return. I shall return.
Return, yes.
Maybe a bit of a picture of MacArthur, because he's an important figure in this
case.
He's a fascinating figure. I mean,
endlessly fascinating.
He was described by his biographer, who was, even though MacArthur was very much a man of the right, his biographer was of the left and said he was unquestionably the finest man of arms the United States has ever produced.
Some will say that he really just got the textbooks down and said, I'll do plan, you know, B B-36, thank you very much, and do that one.
If you're looking at the whole of his career, you can make the case that he succeeded in taking the fight back, pushing the Japanese out of the region, and with minimal loss of life. He was one of those kind of rare generals that thinks the point of a battle is to win rather than to just keep throwing troops at the enemy.
And he thought the kind of US Navy island hopping thing was absurd, what they were doing, you know, going from Tarawa to all these, that was divided, but the Navy was doing. They said, just ignore them, that they can't go anywhere. He wanted to hit them at the Philippines and then just push on basically from there to Japan. And he had this phrase, hit them where they ain't. It's like, don't go into Java where there's this huge Japanese garrison there. Just go to one of the smaller islands and cut them off and starve them out. So yes, you could argue that he was a great campaigner in that way. But the whole fight against the Japanese moved on pretty quickly. We were at the front end for a relatively short period, a fraught and heroic period of time, Kokoda and Milne Bay, etc. We inflicted the first defeat of Japan on land anywhere in August 1942 at Milne Bay. And then the Americans started to take over, pushing them back up the track out of New Guinea. We were mopping up a bit. But by the time it comes to 1944, MacArthur didn't have much use for the Australian Army. He'd promised he'd bring them along for the ride, and the Australians were lobbying to bring them on for the ride. I mean, why we couldn't have just said, we've done our bit, let's all go home, we'll let the Americans do it. That would have been far more sensible, but we didn't. It wasn't the thinking at that time. General Blamey was very, very vociferous and saying, you know, we deserve a... they kept talking about a seat at the table after the war. There was no seat and there was no table after the war. So I don't know what they were going on about, but we thought there was going to be a kind of a Versailles thing where we could shape the destiny of the post-war Pacific. It didn't really happen.
So Australia and the United States pushed the Japanese out of their bases in New Guinea.
Yes.
And the time has come for MacArthur to plan his re-entry to the Philippines. He's going to return, the denouement of
Imperial Japan, which involved a massive invasion of their huge stronghold of the Philippines, from which would be a jumping-off point to what they assumed to be, thank God it didn't happen, a mainland invasion of Japan itself.
So MacArthur had said that Australia would be involved
absolutely,
the liberation of the Philippines.
I shall go into the Philippines and the 1st Australian Army Corps will be by my side. He said that several times, but then didn't do anything about it for months and months and months. And the Australians started to say, well, hang on, are we coming along with this? And they actually, he went into the Philippines in, I think, late 1944. And the Australians went, hello, we're here. They're like the kind of, you know, when you're at school, you're the last kid to be picked in the team because you're the kind of small one. And
right.
But the defeat of Japan, MacArthur had decided very early, would be an all-American affair. He wasn't really prepared to share the glory.
So Australia's political and military leadership very much wanted Australia to be a part of the liberation of the Philippines. What did General Blamey, Australia's military commander-in-chief,
yes,
do when he realised that MacArthur was going to renege on his promise?
He went and confronted him. He flew up to where he was because he'd left Australia and was very happy never to set foot in the place again because he really considered he'd been sort of stuck in a backwater. But he flew to him and basically sort of not quite stormed into his office, but he certainly stormed into Sutherland's office, who was
his chief of staff,
who hated Blamey, and they really hated each other. Sutherland was a very difficult person, and said, you know, I want to see the general. I said, oh, okay, Tom, well, just wait here. We'll see if he's busy. Sir, Tom Blamey's here. He wants to have a word with... He said, oh, okay, Tom, come in. But it was the effect of, what are we doing? Why have you not planned us to be part of this campaign that's already underway? It was, oh, Tom, I'm sorry. MacArthur was strange. He had these strange personal quirks. Some of the most favourite are the fact that he'd love to get... He was already 6 foot four or something, and he'd love to get photographers to squat down so he looked even taller. He would refer to himself in the third person in meetings, like, well, I spoke to General MacArthur the other day, and people were looking around, is there some other General MacArthur we missed? But... one of the things that he was very awkward in personal confrontation. He wasn't good on one-on-one in many ways. And he often had difficulty saying no. And so he kind of fubbed and sort of mumbled that, oh, well, of course, you know, we're great allies and you've been with us since the beginning. We'll find something for you to do.
So where was the AIF? Where were the Australian forces at this point? If you're saying they're not being deployed anywhere, what were they doing?
Training. The Australian Army spent an entire year doing absolutely nothing. Training on the Atherton Tablelands.
In North Queensland.
In North Queensland for a campaign that nobody knew would happen. Huge push within the government to, well, let these people go. We have a manpower shortage. They're obviously not going to be used, and we're paying for them every day they're training. It's costing us a fortune. A lot of them are done. They want to go back into, they're missing their wives and families. They want to get back to their jobs. They're sick of the war. But MacArthur wouldn't allow that to happen. He said, no, I don't want you to disperse the army, but I don't have a use for them. But
why?
Why
was he like that?
Because he thought he might use them as a reserve or something.
So are you saying then that Operation Obo, this planned invasion of Borneo, which mm-hmm. then was the substitute campaign, was this conceived by the Americans as a kind of make-work campaign for
yes,
the Australian Army?
Basically. It was to be the jump-off point for the liberation of the occupied Netherlands East Indies. That the Japanese were all through there, and it was thought that at some stage we're going to have to go in and push them out. The thrust of the defeat of Japan has to be towards the Japanese mainland. However, this empire that they've created in the last few years, that's got to be taken out as well. But it's not the main game.
So how was Operation Obo conceived then, Michael?
It was conceived as originally a six-part invasion of the Netherlands East Indies. Three were scrubbed immediately because they realised it's going to be much too hard. We'll concentrate on Borneo for the purpose of Borneo being a stepping stone to the rest of the Netherlands East Indies.
So it was going to be the Australians being sent into Borneo in various ways at various points on the island. What role was the United States going to have as a supportive role for the Australians going ashore there, Michael?
Almost no one on the ground. Except a couple of amphibious alligator drivers, these big, brilliant amphibious vehicles. And they carried about 30 blokes. They had beach drivers, but no troops as such. It was going to be an all-Australian affair. So the United States had lent their support to us entirely as a support role and couldn't have been done without them.
And what was the scale of this operation from an Australian point of view?
An entire army corps, roughly about 80,000 troops plus their many, many more supporting services. It was massive, by far the largest amphibious thing Australia has ever done and one of the largest things we have ever done.
So when the Australians were sent from North Queensland to Moratai, which was the launching pad
yep.
for the invasion, did they have any idea of where they were going and what they were going to do? Because this obviously has to be conducted
no.
in great secrecy,
oh,
doesn't
no.
it?
Oh, absolutely no idea. They knew Moratai would be a jumping-off point to somewhere else, but they didn't know where. They were told on the ship they were going to Moratai. Then they got to Moratai and camped for a few weeks and did some more training. And then they were told we're going into Borneo, and everyone went, "Where's Borneo?" Well, don't worry, you just need to know about this. But they did interesting things, Australian Army. They'd had a few pretty rough amphibious invasions over the past couple of years in New Guinea where people didn't quite know where they were. So they did interesting things, like they constructed these scale models of the beaches. And when I say scale model, it was almost like one-to-one. Some of these models were like an acre in dimensions. And every tree, every building, every little mosque, every little rock was put into these huge models. And the troops spent a few days just going and having a look at them and being briefed. And
why was that level of preparation?
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
It was extraordinary. Nothing like it had ever been done.
Like the exact
before.
Opposite of the Gallipoli landings, in
the
other
exact
words.
Opposite of the Gallipoli, right. Where they didn't really know what was happening. No, they were also given leave to express their views on things. Look, what do you think about this? How hard's this going to be? And you'd have one of the Matilda tank drivers saying, "Well, we can't get off there. There's a rock there. Oh, okay, maybe we'll move that." So it was actually quite a democratic process. Leslie Morshead, who was a brilliant general, he had that Montgomery principle, "I want every man to know exactly what his job is going to be."
So May the 1st, 1945, the first of the Obo landings take place on the island of Tarakan, which is just off the coast of Borneo, the yeah. east coast of Borneo. What were the objectives of this first part of the invasion?
Two parts. Tarakan had so much oil in it that you just basically walked it, that the troops sort of were walking across grass, puddles, and looked down and their feet were all black.
It's literally like that, was it? Right.
The pace was basically a raft on a massive natural oil reserve. And the Dutch had built a very large oil refinery there up from the beach, which is called Lingas. That was an objective. Another objective was an airstrip that was a couple of miles away, and we wanted to get that too, with the object of using that as a jump-off point for the rest of the Obo landings that would happen over the successive months.
And what kind of forces did the Japanese still have in place around that area?
They had a mixture. They had a lot of composite forces. They probably had like a couple of thousand troops just on Tarakan alone of unknown grade.
And how were they placed? Are they in, like, in pillboxes or concrete pillboxes?
Well,
or?
No one really knew. And this research was a little bit false because, A, it was assumed that even though the Australians had been fighting the Japanese for years and they never surrendered, it was assumed, look, the Japs know that they're done, they can't win. We think we've broken them. It's just going to be a clean-up operation. In fact, the description, it's going to be more like a complicated exercise than a battle. And it did not turn out to be that way at all. The Japanese fought with an unbelievable, illogical, suicidal ferocity that confounded everyone, even up until almost the last days of the war when they started to surrender.
You say the two objectives were these oil facilities.
Yep.
Tarakan, and the airstrip just beyond.
Yes.
What happened to those facilities after the initial bombardment from all the arranged warships that were just off the coast?
Not just the warships, massive naval firepower, but also the Royal Australian Air Force flying their long-range Liberator bombers from Darwin and Moratai. Their job was to soften the landing areas up and to attack all Japanese defences. What they did, they plastered it so badly that any kind of use that could have been got out of the oil refineries was completely smashed. The soldiers got there and there was no oil refinery left. Aren't we supposed to be here to take this so we can use the oil?
And what about the airstrip?
The airstrip was even worse. They had to fight to get there. And when the engineers got and looked at the airstrip, they said, we can't use this. Look at it.
So you're saying to me that right at the very outset, the two objectives our soldiers were supposed to take had both been destroyed by our own people?
Utterly wrecked. All they had to do was basically bomb around the runway because they had lots of anti-aircraft defences and machine guns. They bombed right down the middle of the runway. The thing was below virtually on the waterline anyway, so at high tide, all through these bomb craters, the water came up and it turned it into a complete swamp. So they spent weeks and weeks and weeks trying to drain it and then fill it in. There's one great story of one of those big sort of diesel rollers, like, you know, what you roll a cricket pitch with, and it was left overnight somewhere, and in the morning it had gone. It had sunk into the ground and was never seen again.
But then if both the military objectives have been destroyed by our own people, by air bombardment and by naval bombardment.
You're going to ask a very logical question here, and I don't have the answer.
Was the next decision to withdraw our troops?
No, it was to keep on going. Oh, well, look, we're here now, more or less. Keep on going, and we'll round up the
Jesus, did the soldiers
Japanese.
Mutiny at that point?
Not really, because the other aspect of it was that for many, many of the soldiers who were on Borneo, this was their first and last campaign. A lot of the old blokes who'd been in North Africa had gone home, and there were a lot of new guys who were desperate to get into a bit of fighting before the war ended, so they were very happy to be there. But it was much tougher than anything that they'd seen.
Was there a lot of criticism of the RAAF for bombing
the
objectives they're supposed to take? I'm laughing, but this is very black humour.
The RAAF had recently had what was referred to as the Moratai Mutiny, which was where a lot of senior Royal Australian Air Force officers who were based on Moratai being sent off to do kind of dangerous work, basically mopping up and ground strafing. There were no Japanese fighters or anything to contend with. And they came back and said, this is stupid. What are we doing this for? All these Japanese forces are isolated, starving and trapped, and it's dangerous because they're firing back at us. And some of our young blokes are having accidents because ground attacks are very dangerous because especially if you're inexperienced in a very, very powerful aircraft, you misjudgment and in a split second you don't pull up quick enough and you go in and you're dead. It was happening in far more than battle casualties. So the RAAF sort of had a bit of a mutiny. The RAAF did not cover themselves in glory on this. They often didn't show up. They bombed the wrong places. So, no, RAAF was not their finest hour.
Meanwhile, the Australians are making their way further inland. What did the soldiers describe the nights were like on this island?
How this campaign evolved was that the Japanese, it was completely schizoid, because the Australians attacked by day and the Japanese basically hid and retreated or had to be wheedled out. But at night, the Japanese came out and attacked the Australian camps. So it was this 24-hour cycle of attack and retreat in daylight and nocturnally. So the nights were horrible. Because Japanese had incredibly good night vision, and nobody still can explain to me why, how they managed to find their way in pitch black through jungle tracks and attack the Australians. And often they were out of ammunition. They'd often use things like spears, and had a lot of hand grenades, but they didn't have much ammunition, but a lot of knives and weird spears and things like that, homemade bombs. On the three campaigns, the Japanese mining and booby trapping was incredible. Thousands and thousands of reconverted sea mines, aerial bombs that they had tripwires to. It was really dangerous. That killed a lot of people.
What did that do to the mindset of the Australian soldiers, where at night in that pitch black of the jungle, which is still full of noise to begin with?
Yes, yes.
I just wonder how there must have been the terror of that.
There was the terror, but even at the height of battle, some soldiers slept through it because they were so tired. There was some bloke I saw interviewed and said, yeah, a couple I slept through, but my mate was going to wake me, but he said, oh, no, he needs a bit of sleep. And I slept through the whole thing. They were that exhausted, and the humidity was terrible. It was this kind of airless fog down in these very complicated little ravines and hilly valleys full of scrub and jungle and swamp.
So the first phase of this campaign came to an end. The Japanese were clearly beaten. What happened when Brigadier General Whitehead offered a truce to the Japanese forces?
It was basically completely ignored. They'd just suffered one of their biggest defeats there, that they'd overtaken one of the main kind of little fortresses there, the headquarters, and Whitehead said, look, I may as well see if they want to surrender. They're just about done. This is getting just ridiculous. They had to find where the Japanese headquarters was, because no one quite knew where they actually were. But he managed to find them and get the message, and I'll arrange to meet on this hill and these coordinates at midday, and carry we'll carry a white flag, and you carry a white flag, and we'll see you, and I'll allow you to surrender with honour. Your Imperial Japanese soldiers have fought with great bravery and honour, but now's the time to wrap it all up. The only response on the stroke of midday was a single shell being fired from somewhere in the jungle, landing quite close to that hill, and the guy waited till 1 p.m, and that was it, and they went back to fighting.
Meanwhile, there were landings taking place in North Borneo. What were the goals of the landings in the north of the island?
More or less the same. Again, a vast oil reserves along the North Borneo coast. The island of Labuan, which some described as kind of looking like a rampant bear that kind of guards the entrance into this enormous harbour of North Borneo, where Brunei and places like that are. They had to take that first. It was another big slog. The Japanese conformed to their usual pattern of more or less surrendering the beaches and moving inland and fortifying the inland areas. But this had some other strange sidebar stories, North Borneo. There was this whole river campaign. It was something like out of Apocalypse Now,
right?
Where they go up the rivers in boats because the area was so swampy, and they wanted to get to one of the towns called Beaufort, because that's where the final battle of North Borneo happened. But they were sort of sailing through jungles and having ambushes, and the Americans facilitated that. Then there was another part of the army that stretched out south down the North Borneo coast to find that the Japanese had set fire. Do you remember when the Gulf War happened and all those burning oil wells that went for weeks and weeks?
Yes.
It was exactly like that. A lot of the Australian soldiers had to improvise as firemen to work out how to put these fires out. And they came up with this amazing, ingenious ways to blow the fire out. Someone found an old wingless Mitsubishi Zero in a Japanese Air Force and dragged it, started it up and used it as a fan to actually blow one of the fires out. But eventually they managed to do it.
The local indigenous people on Borneo, the Dayak people, were brought in to be part of the Allied campaign. Tell me how that happened.
That's a fabulous story. Before the actual landings, they dropped a handful of Australian special forces in. These guys took off not knowing what their brief was, or what their mission was, or where they were going. They were told on the plane.
Right, go into the jungles of Borneo, meet up with the local indigenous people, of whose language you do not speak.
Yes.
Reach out to them, get them on our side, because we assume they hate the Japanese as much as
that
we do.
That is it in an absolute nutshell.
Right.
You could not be more succinct. And they were also told, look, we haven't told them you are coming, but we hear that they're pretty good fighters. I mean, you know, they
know the terrain. They know all of that.
They know the terrain. We think they really hate the Japanese, but we don't really know, and B, we haven't told them that you're coming. So you're turning up cold. Find your way to a chief. Say, look, I'm wondering if you want to help us fight the Japanese. We're going to be coming in soon and pushing them out. So their reaction will be either they'll kill you, they'll hand you to the Japanese who'll kill you, or they'll be your best mate. And thank goodness it was the last one.
How were they able to help, Michael?
What then transpired was the Australian commandos suddenly realised that these native tribes people not only were more than willing to fight the Japanese, they were the most brilliant natural soldiers they had ever seen.
What do you mean by that?
They were smart, they were utterly fearless, had no sense of physical fear whatsoever. They could learn to handle a modern rifle in about 20 minutes. They were all good shots. They could drill. You show them, like, this is how you stand to attention. Bang! And they were absolutely champing at the bit to go and get the Japanese. They used some of their own weapons. One of the most brilliant weapons was the blowpipe, which, you know, that thing, that huge 6-foot piece of bamboo, whatever it was, and that apparently found this tree in the middle of the island with a toxin in it that's basically pure strychnine. And they had this thorn that they – look, it's so nuts, this story.
So this silent lethal weapon.
Right. And the best thing about – and they could aim it to within an inch of where they wanted it to go. So it's a classic thing in the 1930s movies. Thong, something in the neck, you start to stagger, and in about, you know, 3 or 4 minutes, you're dead. And that actually happened. There's one story of an Australian soldier sort of training, trying to use a blowpipe, and he accidentally scratches his finger on one of these thorns and is hospitalised for 4 days.
So at this point, General Douglas MacArthur decided to come and pay a visit, inspection in northern Borneo, see how the Australians were getting on. On the one hand, this is again speaks to the complexity of MacArthur as a figure.
Yes.
Doesn't like personal confrontation, but in battle, utterly fearless of enemy fire. What happened when he waded ashore and started walking around the beaches in northern Borneo?
Yes, he turned up on the first day of Obo 6, and these blokes that were manning a position a few hundred yards up from the beach, they turned around and saw flashbulbs going off and, like, you know, kind of a party moving up the beach, and said, what the hell's that? That's Douglas MacArthur. And hang on, that's Blamey and that's General Moorshead. What are they doing here? And it was basically they had a little conference. Indeed, the beach was not quite secure. 50 metres away from MacArthur, there were two Japanese found who'd been hiding in a big concrete pipe, armed, and they were flushed out and taken away, but they could easily have fired a couple of pot shots off.
There was a part of the island, a fortified position known as the Pockets, that the Japanese were holed up in and subjecting the Australians to murderous fire. The Japanese were kind of trapped in this position. Tell me about how they tried to break out from this pocket.
Well, this is one of the only examples of the Borneo campaign where the Americans become involved. There was a natural inland fortress that the Japanese had dug into. To what extent, nobody actually knew, but there were more and more of them and they didn't stop firing. One night, for somehow, the Japanese managed to leave their little fortress, slip down an old creek bed, go past the Australian lines and turned up more or less down at the beach where the American amphibious regiment was camped with their big alligator-tracked vehicles and basically stormed the camp, about 30 or 40 of them, completely out of the blue, unexpectedly. And there was this huge firefight down on the beach where nobody knew who was what. The two American sentries were running through the camp saying, "The Japs are here, the Japs are here," and everyone bursting out, firing at everything, knowing it's a miracle there was no friendly fire. But the Japanese were actually doing very well because they were prepared to die. In fact, the orders found on the leader was saying basically, "We're all going to die, but well, at least we'll die with glory." But the Japanese sort of set fire to a few things, which completely gave away their only advantage, which was the darkness. So finally, they could overcome them. The Americans lost more in that little engagement that only lasted 3 or 4 hours than they had in the fighting in the previous year.
Meanwhile, in Australia, this is this fascinating sidebar to this whole story. Back in Melbourne, in Australia, there's talk within this very strange and interesting institution in Melbourne. Yeah. There's talk of not handing Borneo back to its Dutch and British colonial masters. Instead, there's talk of making Borneo an Australian colony after the war. Yeah. What was going on here, Michael?
It's one of the strangest stories. And in the midst of war, there's always some comic relief if you dig. And this is it. There was, as you said, it's one of those peculiar organisations within the Australian Army called the Directorate of Research and Civil Affairs.
Right, that sounds very banal.
And the organisation was as nebulous as it sounds. It was basically a think tank before think tanks were invented. And this very Svengalian but kind of brilliant guy called Alf Conlon, who was kind of an eternal student in Sydney University and rose to the heights of student politics during early in the war, and a huge gift of the gab, managed to convince generals and then Curtin that you need some people who are kind of in the army but kind of not to kind of think about things, to do some interesting research, put out some interesting papers, solve some problems that might be a bit awkward for you guys.
Right. The things that people would now call out-of-the-box thinking.
Is yes, very much so.
This sounds like one of those wacky units that was attached to the CIA that came up with MKUltra or something
it's
like
exactly
that.
Exactly the same
right.
kind of thing.
We were going to come up with all these wacky ideas and throw them at a wall and see what sticks. That's the idea?
It was staffed with poets, winemakers, I'm not kidding, librarian, quite a lot of women were involved in it, academics, this whole bunch of people who had nothing to do with the army and were given ranks like major and colonel and had no military training whatsoever. The rest of the army was aghast. They were given a hut down in St Kilda Barracks in Melbourne, which everyone looked at, oh, they're the weirdos over there. We don't know what they're doing.
The boffins, the wine drinkers and the
pipe
smokers, right?
That's right. They actually did some interesting things, a lot of anthropological research and blah, 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 particularly in the Pacific. Alf Conlon, who was the leader of it, thought, why should we hand British, so it was only British Borneo, they didn't try it with the Dutch, but British North Borneo, why should we hand it back? This is our patch. Where are the people liberating it? We've already got big chunks of New Guinea.
Yeah, because Papua New Guinea was our colony.
We picked it up after World War One.
Right, yeah. From the Germans, yes.
From the Germans, yes. Why should we just hand it back to the British? We're the people that are pushing the Japanese out.
But they think, well, like Papua New Guinea, we can make Borneo, which is quite a way further to the north, and you've got to leap over Java to get there.
Absolutely.
We're going to make northern Borneo an Australian colony.
Because our armed forces were going to be there anyway. Now, in London, they were planning for their colonial administration unit to move back in as soon as the Japanese had been pushed out by the Australians. But they were diverted to Australia, and Alf Conlon arranged for them to be basically held up in house arrest in Holdsworthy Bay. For weeks and weeks and weeks. And these English guys were being very distressed, sort of going, why? Hang on, aren't we supposed to be in Borneo? And Conlon's saying, yeah, look, it isn't safe yet. We haven't secured it.
Right.
Meanwhile, he was trying all this backroom stuff. Let's get our administrative team in there. So he actually put some of his own administrative team in there to run it. But they were hopeless and didn't know what to do and were pleading backroom, saying, we can't run a colony.
Well,
it's really
hard. Had he run this by John Curtin, Prime Minister John Curtin, or Ben Chifley by then?
Blamey, yes.
Right.
Blamey thought it was a good idea up to a point because he was so – he didn't like the Brits much, Blamey. He really didn't. He'd been very patronised by them in Greece and the Middle East, and he was over them. He thought they fought wars stupidly. So he was happy for it to be kicked down the road a bit.
So if we took over Borneo, it'd be a bit of a... He'd stick it right up the British then.
Yeah, it would be a huge coup.
Right.
Who knows how it could have actually happened. When he actually tried to put one of his units in to run it as a civil affair thing, they couldn't do it and were pleading back home, get us out of here. Bring the British back. We actually don't know how to do this. We haven't been trained. And it was hopeless. Then Curtin died. As you know, Curtin died on the job from exhaustion in office. And then the whole thing fell to pieces because there were people in the government that hated the directorate, hated Blamey, and then basically went in and said, stop this nonsense immediately. Arrange for the British to go back and sort things out. And that was the end of it. But
it's a fun little thought bubble, though, while it lasted.
It's a fun little thought bubble. It's one of the most... And it was also the place where the Ern Malley affair originated, Australia's greatest literary hoax.
All right, now let me just paraphrase this. The Ern Malley hoax you're talking about here, this was where several Australian poets...
Two
Australian poets decided they hated modern poetry so much, they would create this fake working-class poet called Ern Malley, submit his kind of poetry, which they thought was absurd, to Max Harris's magazine, The Angry Penguins, and see what would happen. And, of course, very duly, The Angry Penguins were delighted by this poetry and thought, we found this kind of working-class genius, and they published his work, and then the whole thing was exposed as
hoax.
That's right. What's the connection here?
They were in the directorate. They were working in this office that was cooking up this scheme. They were a couple of the poets.
Aren't we supposed to be contemplating the takeover of Borneo?
That's right.
What, and they're concocting a literary hoax?
That's what they're doing. The other guy, you'll love this, the other big operator within the directorate, get this, was a young John Kerr.
As in
the Governor General.
Who sacked Gough Whitlam.
Indeed. He was a young hotshot lawyer from Sydney Uni, and he was in the directorate too, but we are sidetracking. It was a crazy organisation. So many weird things happened, and this was just one of them.
Well, let's go back to the fighting on Borneo. This is all good, because that's really the main game here. The last man, Australian, to receive the Victoria Cross in World War II was a man called Les Stasevich.
Les Stasevich.
Tell me about him.
He was a young guy. He was from Grass Patch, Western Australia. It's near Kalgoorlie somewhere. And this was on North Borneo, and he was with a platoon that was pinned down. They were actually on their way through down a jungle track, and there were a couple of clearings either side, and they were trying to reach another group of men, about 30 men, that were also pinned down by dug-in Japanese machine guns. And they'd been put out there for like a couple of hours in this clump of jungle, and it was a stalemate. Everyone was on the ground, because you put their head up and the Japanese would start firing. And everyone... So, well, what are we going to do here? We can't go back and we can't go forward. And the guy at the head of the platoon remembers, he called it, I was lying on the ground. We'd been lying there for an hour or so. And I looked next to me and there was a pair of boots next to me. And I looked up and there was Les standing in full view of the enemy. And he landed and said, hey, mate, can I borrow your Bren gun? And he said, sure, Les, what are you going to do? Thanks, that's it. Takes his Bren gun, walks out into full view of these three Japanese machine gun with woodpecker machine guns. The Japanese are so stunned that for about half a minute they don't know what's happening. They hang on, have we missed something here? He starts walking towards them, starts firing from his hip, kills the first two men in the first machine gun post, walks another 50 metres, kills two men in that machine gun post, then another 60 metres and knocks off that machine gun post too. They're firing at him constantly. He is not hit with a single bullet. And they say he was completely calm, completely dispassionate before, during and afterwards. And they all went out and said, Les, oh, that's incredible. And then 2 hours later, he did it all again.
What do you mean?
He found that they were pinned down another couple of kilometres down the road with another series of pre-sighted Japanese machine gun nests, and he killed them again. Les should have been pierced like a sieve with bullets, and not one hit him.
Now, we're getting into the final days of the Second World War, but no one knows this yet because it's going to be ended by the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But no one knows this at this
point.
No one
knows this, no.
So in the 1st of July 1945, the landing takes place right in the middle of Borneo on Balikpapan. Now, this is the landing that Bruce Ruxton, we met right at the start, was involved in.
Yes.
How successful was this landing ashore?
It was very successful. The Americans wanted to do it slightly differently than the Australians, but the Australians held their ground, said, no, we're doing it our way. General Milford stood his ground. The Americans wanted to land further up the beach away from the town of Balikpapan. Milford said, no, we're going straight in, and he stuck to his guns, literally, and it was a success. And this is Balikpapan was almost a kind of a resort town for the Dutch before the war, so there was a lot of urban fighting. But again, the refinery, and you see the pictures of the oil refinery that had all been smashed up and burnt, they're like the huge oil tank farms that were all burnt, and so the metal had melted, so they were like huge deflated balloons all burned out. It's kind of weird and surreal. They brought the tanks in. Australia had developed a special flame-throwing tank, which they dubbed the Frog, which is one of the only things that could wheedle the Japanese out. Very brutal weapon. They used those in Balikpapan. And there was another airfield to be taken. And this is when I actually, for the book, I interviewed Les Cook, and he's still with us at 104, the last living survivor of the Borneo campaign, one of the last living soldiers of the Second World War. And his description of some of these unknown skirmishes and battles that happened around this campaign, it was like being storyboarded a Hollywood war film. It was quite incredible.
You know, that cliche about the First World War, which was that Australian and British soldiers were lions led by donkeys, that sort of thing. This seems to be a campaign of lions led by lions. Like, the Australian military leadership was first rate, highly professional, carefully prepared for absolutely everything. It was an extraordinary success. On the 21st of July 1945, General Milford, this brilliant Australian general, ordered the cessation of large-scale patrols. He figured the Japanese were beaten. And then the bomb is dropped on Hiroshima, another one is dropped on Nagasaki, and that's the end of the war, isn't it? Does it end in a bang or a whimper?
Absolute whimper. In fact, it petered on a bit for a while because, of course, the Japanese were isolated. They had no radio. They had to be convinced that
the emperor had effectively conceded that the war was over. Right.
Yes. Some just wandered off. There's sort of odd stories of the native people weeks after the end of the war still seeing sort of squads of starving Japanese soldiers sort of trudging along some track to nowhere and were never seen again. Some of them indeed started to surrender. And the weird thing about when the Japanese did eventually surrender is because surrendering was so inconceivable within the Japanese army, they hadn't been trained to do when you were captured alive. And so when they did were captured, they often talked like canaries. They sung like canaries and gave away all these sort of this sensitive information because nobody had told them not to. But the war kind of indeed, it petered out.
How do war historians assess the success of the Oboe campaign? Putting aside its strategic goals, the success of the campaign, of the job that the men were sent there to do.
Well, it is such a good question, Richard, because it's never really been done, except in a few kind of very high-end and brilliantly written, but almost like industry journals. But in the wider community, and we know so much about the other earlier campaigns, Alamein and Kokoda and Milne Bay and all those other ones, this huge thing happened right at the end of the war. It was militarily a success, but it's been overshadowed by the fact that its very raison d'etre was highly doubtful. If Oboe had not happened at all, it would have had no effect on the end of the Second World War, none whatsoever. So I think that is unarguable.
And then there was the terrible atrocity and war crime of the Sandakan Death March, took place on Borneo, not far from where those men had only pretty much come to an end before the Borneo landings.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. That was earlier in 1945. But nobody knew about that. So when the soldiers came back, they started hearing about, while you were happening, 2,000 of our blokes were massacred on this death march and they were right near you. Did you do anything about it? And they said, well, we didn't know about it. And that's one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why particularly the men from Borneo, particularly the Bruce Ruxtons, came back and really felt like they'd been ignored. They'd done this incredible feat, but they came back and felt no one's actually interested in what we've just done.
I'd never heard this story before. I mean, I don't follow military history anywhere near as closely as you do, but I know a bit about it.
Nor had I.
I had never heard of this story before.
It's like the Australians' effort against the Japanese in World War II, blah, blah, blah. Oh, and then there's that thing in Borneo at the very end. But it's so not what the reality was.
Because if you're looking at a linear story of the war in the Pacific, it's the Japanese come down, they take all of that territory, they attack Darwin and Broome, they get as far as that. They take the northern coast of New Guinea. Then MacArthur arrives, and there's the pushback of the Japanese forces out of the region. And you go from New Guinea to the Philippines to the Okinawa, and then the bombs drop, and that's that. So Borneo doesn't fit on that track,
no.
Does it? That single track narrative. It seems like a sidebar or something to the story we tell ourselves about the Second World War.
Even geographically, it was a sideshow, literally a sideshow, because it was aside from the main thrust of the war, the island hopping, getting closer to Japan. Borneo was way down here, was way down at sort of 7 o'clock on the clock face. And what was it for? I mean, everyone thought, well, the real war was happening up there. What were you guys doing here?
In the last ticking moments of the Second World War.
Yes.
But as you say, this was fought extremely professionally.
As a feat of arms, it's really one of our most magnificent and proudest achievements. Australians fought with, as you say, from top down with huge professionalism, bravery, like so many military medals were awarded to private soldiers during this campaign.
So you've spoken to the last surviving veteran of that campaign.
Yes.
What about the kids of those veterans? Have they contacted you since you've written your book?
I think just about every day on my social media, I'm getting a text from someone saying, my dad was in Borneo, my uncle was in Borneo, my granddad, I knew he was there, but I didn't know anything about it. And thank you for filling the blanks. And always, always that sort of doleful tone, I wish I'd asked him more about it when he was still alive. And there's nothing you can do about that now, except occasionally remember what they did. I started writing interviewing former air crew, and I remember, I think about it every couple of days, one of the last fellows, he was nearly 100 at that stage, and I asked him at his front gate, what do you want from us? Like, you know, you went through all this incredible cauldron of fire and violence and heroism in your youth. Well, what do you expect from today's generation? He said, oh, not much, just to be remembered sometimes, not always, but just sometimes. Certainly explained a lot about Bruce Ruxton. You know, I watch him on the telly a couple of times, and he's angry man, and sort of, I think if someone had said, you know, thanks for doing what you did, Bruce, I know it was all a bit, it was all a bit hairy and was all a bit controversial, and maybe it shouldn't have happened, but geez, he did a bloody good job, so thanks, mate. That's probably all he wanted.
Thank you for telling this story, Michael. It's been fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Richard.
Podcast. Broadcast and online. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feindler.
Michael Veitch's book is called Borneo, The Last Campaign, Australia's Brilliant, Controversial End to World War II. Today's conversation with Michael Veitch was made on the lands of the Gadigal people. Producer is Maggie Morris. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feindler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feindler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.